Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, March 17th, 2022. Man who went missing with daughter in National Park, indicted by grand jury on child endangerment charge. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. On March 10th, a federal grand jury indicted Hector Flores Jr. of Fort Stockton on one count of child endangerment. Flores and his daughter went missing in Big Bend National Park at the end of January and was later found in a remote farming community in Coahuila across the river from the park. The grand jury decided that in the course of their 20-plus mile odyssey, Flores had intentionally placed a child under 15 years of age in imminent danger by not providing adequate food. Flores and his attorney are now waiting to see if the case will go to trial. Authorities were tipped off that Flores and his daughter were missing on February 5th, when a park employee discovered his vehicle abandoned on the rough and remote northern end of Old Ore Road. Clothes, identification, several locks of hair, and drug paraphernalia were scattered around the scene, per court documents. Investigators later found that Flores and his daughter abandoned the vehicle and made their way across the desert on foot, mostly traveling at night to avoid detection. Flores told his daughter that there was going to be an earthquake that would cause a tsunami and Mexico would be a safe place to take shelter, according to the testimony of FBI Special Agent Alice Downey, who spoke at Flores' initial hearing. Downey further testified that Flores' trek into Mexico appeared premeditated. He had checked out books from the local library on wilderness survival and had invested in equipment like water purification tablets. He had also told friends and family prior to his disappearance that he liked the idea of living off-grid in Mexico. Per Downey's testimony, Flores' daughter said they had not eaten in many days. "Thank God we came across some kayakers. They gave us wraps to eat," the child told rangers responsible for her transfer into CPS care. Flores' attorney, Shane O'Neill, disputed the charge. "The indictment is what we expected," he said. "I feel like the government is stretching on the endangerment charge, particularly given the fact Mr. Flores and his daughter didn't require any medical attention. From my conversations with him, they were fairly well supplied. This statute is really meant to penalize people who abandon their children or leave their children in a car, which can cause fairly predictable serious injury, or for cases of neglect. There's no indication that Mr. Flores was anything but a loving father who undertook something that is risky, but also took adequate measures to mitigate that risk." O'Neill said the daughter is currently staying with her grandparents, and that will likely be the long-term arrangement for her care. Flores is still being held in Brewster County Jail. Flores and O'Neill made the decision not to appeal his bond to help court proceedings go more smoothly. O'Neill pitched a few options to the judge, such as letting Flores wear an ankle monitor and restricting contact with his daughter, or sending him to a halfway home in Midland. He declined and instead found no condition can assure Mr. Flores' appearance in court or the community's safety, which I thought was a bit of a stretch, said O'Neill. Flores has been indicted with one federal charge of child endangerment, assimilating a state statute. O'Neill explained that because the alleged child endangerment happened within a national park, federal jurisdiction, Flores can be charged federally with what would otherwise be considered a state crime. In Texas, felony child endangerment is punishable by up to 180 days in jail and a fine of up to $10,000. O'Neill and Flores are currently waiting to see if the case will go to trial. No evidentiary motions have been filed yet, which O'Neill anticipates will come before a date is scheduled. Because of the hybrid state-federal nature of the charge, it may take a while for the next steps to be determined. It's going to be a slightly harder decision than your normal federal case, whether to go to trial, O'Neill explained. There's also an interesting question about whether we can let a jury decide on punishment, because in state court, you can go to the jury for punishment, but in federal court, typically, that's prohibited. The U.S. District Attorney's Office, representing the federal government in this case, did not respond to a request for comment by press time. Safety concerns, pay, and internal strife prompt exodus from Big Bend Regional Medical Center, say former staffers. By Allegra Hobbs, ALLEGRA at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. Like many hospitals across the country, Alpine's Big Bend Regional Medical Center has been facing a staffing crisis for some time. In July of last year, a shortage of nurses trained to deliver babies forced the labor and delivery unit to go on diversion, intermittently closing and diverting patients to farther away facilities. The problem persisted, with the unit regularly going on diversion for days at a time. In December, the wing closed for 2 weeks straight, then Presidio EMT Director Melinda Richardson said at the time. Then, at the end of January, a lack of staff prompted a dramatic restructuring. What had previously been the Med-Surg unit, which offered general care for hospitalized patients, was absorbed into the emergency department, forcing both departments to share limited space. Locals sounded the alarm over safety concerns. Patients treated in the newly combined wing and an EMT who brought patients into the facility told the Big Bend Sentinel similar accounts of an overcrowded facility, with patients relegated to gurneys in the hallway and COVID patients sharing space with non-COVID patients. At the time, hospital spokesperson Ruth Huck insisted the restructuring was temporary and attributable to the nationwide problem of staffing shortages. But former employees tell a different story. In interviews with the Big Bend Sentinel, 8 healthcare workers who have left the hospital since 2020, most of whom requested anonymity, insist hospital leadership has exacerbated staffing issues by declining to give raises to overworked staff, rebutting safety concerns, and fostering a low workplace morale. Former employees said that the hospital made little effort to retain staff and recounted that Rick Flores, the hospital's CEO, had told staff at meetings that they were replaceable. He has said it in every meeting, every town hall meeting, and every private meeting. You are replaceable, said nurse Karen Ramirez, who left the hospital in July of 2021 after 21 years. For 18 of those years, Ramirez had worked as an obstetrical nurse before moving to the operating room in 2019. Now, she works the front desk at a hotel in Alpine. She said she would like to return to the hospital, but not under the current administration. Ramirez said she worked 7 days a week, picking up shifts in obstetrics even after transferring to the OR in order to patch together a paycheck, since she had a hard time acquiring sufficient hours in each department. Her base pay was roughly $40 per hour, she said. If she was not needed in OB, she would choose to go on call to gather more hours, which earned her $2 per hour while she made herself available to be called to work. Meanwhile, travel nurses, nurses who pick up short-term contracts to fill roles at hospitals, were being brought in to ameliorate the staffing shortages that had worsened since 2020. Those nurses, who signed on to 13-week contracts with the possibility of renewal, made significantly more than staffers who had been with the hospital for years, said Ramirez. But for Ramirez, it wasn't about the money. She insists she was content to work more for less. The problem was that she had some serious concerns regarding the quality of care provided by some travel nurses. She recalled one that she felt was not following safety protocols who worked nights, which was a particular concern because you don't have any backup at night. When she brought these concerns to hospital leadership, she says she was rebuffed. I was told, "We don't want to hear it, Karen." These concerns were compounded by a number of incidents in which she was yelled at by a supervising nurse in front of other staff, she said. She decided she could not tolerate the work environment anymore. The administration made no effort to keep her, she said. CEO Rick Flores, she said, told her she was the problem. I felt pushed out, said Ramirez, and some other people that cared for their jobs and cared for their license got pushed out too. Accounts from former employees who requested anonymity when speaking to the Big Bend Sentinel bolstered this narrative. Long-term employees were denied raises while working overtime and tackling areas of work outside of their job descriptions, they said. But the heart of the matter was not about pay, said one former employee. Ultimately, it was that staff felt unappreciated. Flores' view was that people were leaving the hospital to go travel because they were offering a lot of money, which is true. Traveling pays very well, especially right now with COVID prices. But that's not why we were leaving, said the former employee, who asked not to be named. We were leaving because he did not appreciate us. All he had to do was say, "Hey, what will it take to keep you?" Jennifer Wilcoxon, a med-surg nurse who left the hospital in November of 2020, said she was expected to perform the duties of a registered nurse, a higher rank than her actual rank of licensed vocational nurse, though her pay was not adjusted accordingly. She recounted being expected to take on a patient load of 11 to 12 patients, which did not allow her sufficient time to tend to all their needs. Ultimately, she left because the hospital would not accommodate her schedule, but also because she felt she was unable to properly care for her patients. And though she asked multiple times about a salary increase in light of her taking on additional work, she was told a pay raise was not possible. They're addressing the nursing shortage by hiring travelers or contract nurses. Then they're leaving and they're back to a nursing shortage instead of treating their employees correctly in the first place. Then we'd stay, said Wilcoxon, who now works as a travel nurse and part-time at Highland Drug in Alpine. Wilcoxon recalled Flores telling staff they were replaceable during meetings. He's said it many times, "We will replace you," just like that. Another nurse who left the hospital near the end of 2020, Donna Hernandez, recalled similar language from Flores at meetings. "Rick hosted a meeting with all of us in the ER, and he made it very clear that we were very replaceable," she said. "And so we either be satisfied that we had a job or just know that we were easily replaceable." The irony, of course, is that the departed staff were not replaced. An employee who left with a recent wave of departures at the end of February, approximately a month after the hospital combined the med-surg unit with the emergency department, described the staffing shortage at the time of their departure as very dire. The combination of med-surg and the ER was the last straw for the former employee, who requested anonymity. The restructuring sacrificed the quality of patient care, they said, by putting med-surg patients in the limited number of ER rooms, the resources available for emergency patients who needed more consistent monitoring was greatly decreased. As a result, emergency room patients now sometimes wait hours for a bed. Meanwhile, the designed med-surg floor sits empty. "I don't understand it," said the former employee. "It doesn't make any sense." Furthermore, they said, ER rooms are not equipped for med-surg patients. They are not private and are not equipped with bathrooms and showers. The former employee put the situation as they saw it succinctly. "Our hospital is already 6 feet under, and there's no way we can get it out." In a lengthy statement, Huck said that the hospital could not speak to personnel matters publicly as a matter of policy, but said that investing in our people is a top priority and detailed efforts to recruit and retain staff in the face of staffing challenges. Those efforts, according to Huck, include implementing more than $230,000 in pay raises. Huck stated that the hospital had recently announced an across-the-board pay increase that will be in addition to forthcoming merit increases, and that the hospital will be in addition to forthcoming merit, and that the hospital routinely gives out bonuses to those who work extra shifts or provide support for short-staffed departments when possible. Huck further stated that the hospital offers employee referral bonuses to employees in addition to awarding sign-on bonuses for new hires. Per Huck, these measures are part of the hospital's aggressive recruitment strategies. Despite this, Huck said that ongoing staffing shortages have necessitated the hiring of travel nurses and the utilization of federal and state resources. The hospital has brought on 6 temporary staffers from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, she said. "Let us be very clear. It will always be our strong desire to hire full-time, long-term team members," said Huck. Huck further stated that the hospital welcomes feedback from staff. "Because we are all in this together, we speak openly with our staff and involve them in decision-making," she said. To properly prepare and involve our staff, CEO Rick Flores discusses staffing and resource needs in town hall meetings. "We respect our staff's input, and it is openly solicited both in these town halls and in clinical department-specific meetings." As for the combined med-surg unit and emergency department, Huck said the decision was made under best practice guidance and to ensure we could safely continue to provide care to as many patients as possible. The hospital had sought feedback from the Trauma Regional Advisory Council of Texas in making the decision, she said. The hospital hoped to end the consolidation in April, she said. "As with any hospital, our volumes fluctuate, but we maintain patient staffing ratios in accordance with industry standards," said Huck. Huck did not address former employees' claims that Flores had told staff they were replaceable. Though the Big Bend Sentinel asked to speak with Flores, the CEO was not made available for an interview. Flores himself did not return a call seeking comment by press time. Brewster County Commissioners, Alpine City Council select El Paso-based Emergent Air as new EMS provider. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Brewster County. In separate meetings held Tuesday night, Brewster County Commissioners Court and Alpine City Council voted unanimously to select El Paso-based Emergent Air to serve as North Brewster County's new emergency services provider. All 3 of the vendor candidates would have been good choices, but the task force felt Emergent Air was the best fit for Alpine, Brewster County, said EMS Task Force member and Terlingua Fire and EMS Director Greg Hennington in an email. Terlingua Fire and EMS stepped up to help provide 911 services for North Brewster County in December after Michael Scudder, longtime operator of Alpine EMS, passed away unexpectedly. Out of concern for overextending his crew, Hennington capped their assistance with a deadline of April 30th. Knowing they were up against a deadline, Judge Eleazar Cano assembled an EMS task force to focus on establishing a new EMS provider, with county commissioners and city council also assessing the options. County commissioners held a special meeting recently to hear three vendor proposals for EMS services from Emergent Air, American Medical Response, and City Ambulance Services. A previously discussed option to start a county-run EMS lost steam, with officials citing not enough time to develop the service. In Tuesday's commissioner's court meeting, Cano said the other two vendors were also well-qualified, but in the end, they had to make a tough decision. It's like interviewing a person. There's three or four good candidates, and at the end of the day, you can only choose one. That's just the way the world works, said Cano. It was previously stated that all potential vendors, including Emergent Air, agreed to operate North Brewster County EMS services on pre-existing subsidies previously provided to Scudder by the county and city. $13,397.75 a month from the city and $15,000 a month from the county, adding up to a total of $336,000 a year. The company will likely hold separate contracts from the county and the city. Hennington said the city and county will now move into the contract negotiation phase with Emergent Air, with the company taking over full responsibility for North Brewster County EMS services on or before April 30th. In the meeting, Judge Cano said the contracts would likely be for 1 to 2 years to allow for flexibility in the future. Ronnie Dodson, Brewster County Sheriff, is a member of the EMS Task Force and said it was a unanimous decision among task force members to recommend Emergent Air. He said the company was ultimately a better fit than the larger corporations and that when task force members called references, people had positive reviews of Emergent Air and their services. He said they seemed like down-to-earth people who would fit in with the community. Before the brief meeting concluded, Judge Cano commented that the whole situation was rather unfortunate, with the tragic deaths of Michael Scudder and his brother Mark Scudder happening in close succession, but that by selecting a private EMS vendor, they found a viable solution for the community. Now, we're at a time where we need to go ahead and start looking toward the future. I think we did a really good job going through all the options. Like Hennington mentioned, the whole county-run EMS, it would have been nice to build our own home from scratch, but how many of us have the money and the time to do that? Realistically, this is what we're dealing with. Proposed Southside Alpine Brewery meets pushback from residents who fear impact on neighborhood. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL, at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine, Chisos Brewing, a local family-run craft beer company, is coming up against criticism from Southside residents as it seeks to build a block-long facility on Murphy Avenue that would include a two-story tap room, production building, and an outdoor beer garden, with citizens protesting potential environmental and cultural impacts. Alpine has been without a local brewery since Big Bend Brewing Company filed for bankruptcy and announced they were closing in the summer of 2019 after operating for 6 years. Chisos Brewing, a family affair headed by Lisa and Guy Fielder, whose son Tim handles brewing operations, is looking to provide residents with a replacement, they said. The Fielders acquired a lot on Murphy Avenue between 3rd and 4th Streets, close to downtown Alpine, where they intend to build their production facility and tap room. Chiso's Brewery has been over a year in the making, said Lisa. The Big Bend Brewery was really fun. It didn't have a great tap room, but it was a fun place to go and a gathering place for all Alpinians. I think Alpine misses their brewery, and I think Alpine deserves a brewery, said Chiso's co-founder, Lisa Fielder. But not all Alpine residents are sold on the idea of a new brewery. Lonnie Rodriguez and wife Paula Wilson, who have been living on the predominantly Hispanic south side of town, a block away from Chiso's proposed location for the past 6 years, have launched a petition opposing the brewery with the help of an attorney. Among other objections, petitioners are concerned the brewery would not fit in with the surrounding neighborhood, would bring an influx of traffic to the area, and that its operations could have negative environmental impacts. Rodriguez said so far they have gathered around 70 signatures from other concerned residents and will continue to circulate the petition, eventually turning it into City Hall. I just want as many folks as possible to know what we're doing. Citizens also need to know that all the kinks are not worked out for the Fielders, said Rodriguez. Design plans for Chiso's Brewery's new site have recently been finalized, said Lisa, and they intend to move in on to the next phase of acquiring construction drawings, necessary city permits, and construction bids. The lot they intend to build on did not previously host any infrastructure, and so far the only permit the Fielders have acquired is one to put up an 8-foot fence around the property. Lisa said if all goes according to plan, they hope to open January of 2023 at the earliest. The Fielders estimate the new brewery will initially require around 12 employees and up to 25 should the need arise in the future. Chiso's will brew and sell a variety of ciders and beers, including Belgian and German-style beers, as well as stouts and sours. They will also import beers from other craft breweries in Texas to pour in their tap room. Tim said he expects their yearly output of beer to amount to 6,000 barrels, or barrels of beer, which classifies Chiso's as a nano brewery, a designation below a micro brewery, which produces at least 15,000 barrels of beer a year. The Fielders first purchased the old Hotel Ritchie building, also on Murphy Avenue, intending to use it for the brewery, but ultimately decided to sell the structure after discovering it would need significant structural repairs, and even then would not suit their business's needs. The Hotel Ritchie was built in 1886 and is a recorded Texas Historic Landmark. It turned out to be a beloved building in Alpine, and there was a great outcry about don't demolish the Ritchie, said Lisa. So instead we sold the Ritchie. The Fielders, Rodriguez and Wilson, along with another Alpine citizen opposing the brewery, recently met to discuss the community's initial concerns regarding the brewery project. Parking and traffic, wastewater, odor, and the building's appearance and scale. The Big Bend Sentinel was not present at the meeting but spoke to parties after the fact and obtained meeting notes provided by the Fielders. While the meeting may have addressed certain issues, it did not result in those opposing the brewery throwing their weight behind the project. They talked about the cultural fit, that it's the wrong size, the wrong shape, it's too modern, it's too new, that it doesn't fit into the neighborhood, said Lisa. Chiso's Brewery's design plan shows the facility will consist of two structures, a stucco-finished tap room and a metal-sheathed production facility, both standing at two stories, joined in the center by a garden and outdoor seating area covered by an exposed beam structure. There will also be an outdoor catwalk that will lead to an observation tower. The tap room will be outfitted with a commercial kitchen, said Lisa, so those wishing to host events at the space may do so. Lisa said their desire is to create a native garden with water features to imitate a park-like setting. The fielders are working with a local native plant expert to conceptualize the garden and a local artist to fabricate native animal sculptures for the property, Lisa said. When complete, the brewery would also include spaces for children and pets. Rodriguez said he would prefer Chisos Brewery operate a production facility elsewhere and reduce the size of the brewery to a smaller, more neighborhood-friendly one-story tap room. We don't have anything against breweries. Our son owns a brewery in the Austin area, but we're really trying to get them to scale it down, said Rodriguez. Lisa said the family did a lot of research on how breweries affect economies of rural communities, and based on those findings, believe being in downtown Alpine will benefit other area businesses. It seemed to make sense, more sense to benefit Alpine to put a brewery downtown so that the overflow from us will visit other local businesses, but also is a benefit to us because we get foot traffic from those businesses, said Lisa. The city's official zoning map classifies the property as residing in a C1 neighborhood commercial district, defined as intended to provide for the establishment of restricted commercial facilities to serve the conveniences and needs of the immediate neighborhood and must be compatible with the residential character and environment of the neighborhood. These uses generally result in limited traffic generation. Examples listed are bakeries employing no more than 5 persons, washaterias, restaurants, and taverns. Rodriguez said the brewery doesn't seem to qualify under those guidelines, and he is worried the large-scale design will negatively impact the look and feel of historic Murphy Street. I hardly see how a 2.5-story metal building on Murphy Street fits all that. It sure doesn't provide for the immediate needs of the neighborhood, said Rodriguez. It's a huge building. I mean, it looks like a strip mall. It's a whole block. In regards to parking, documents provided by the fielders show they purchased a 22,641-square-foot parking lot from Union Pacific Railroad Company across the street from the brewery site and obtained a 3-year renewable contract to host an additional 10,000 square feet of overflow parking in the Alpine Farmers Market parking lot during select hours. The fielders addressed concerns of increased traffic by stating semi-trucks would only be visiting the facility a couple of times a year to deliver grain, but they would be infrequent, said Lisa. Lisa said at some point the fielders attempted to buy properties surrounding the brewery in order to provide a wider buffer for noise, but none of the neighbors wanted to sell. I feel like we've tried really hard to honor Alpine and the citizens and to do the right thing and to be neighborly, said Lisa. Another ongoing issue being discussed by both the brewery's opponents and the fielders is whether or not Southside residents would patronize the brewery. Lisa said locating Chisos Brewery on the south side of town was a deliberate act in order to provide the area with something it is missing. We feel that the south side has been historically neglected in terms of economic growth and economic investment, so we hope that our brewery will begin to address that, said Fielder. Rodriguez said it was unlikely that the neighboring community would visit the brewery, and he believes the families he has talked to that have lived in the area for 70-plus years are the center of Murphy Street, not a brewery. We're predominantly Mexican people on this side, and older Mexican people. The brewery is not going to benefit them, said Rodriguez. My view is that those are the folks that are anchors to Murphy Street. They've been here that many years. And there's no consideration for those folks at all from the fielders. In addition to concerns over cultural impact, Rodriguez said he and other citizens are worried about the potential environmental impacts of the production facility, namely the amount of water that will be needed to operate the brewery. On average, breweries require 217 gallons, or 7 barrels, of water to produce 31 gallons, or 1 barrel, of beer, according to the Brewers Association. We're in a drought. You don't need to be brewing beer with our water, said Rodriguez. Data from the National Integrated Drought Information System reports that in Brewster County, 9,232 people are currently being affected by drought, with 100% of the county experiencing abnormally dry conditions and over half of the county experiencing what are classified as extreme drought conditions. Rodriguez said poor water pressure in the south side of Alpine has also been an ongoing problem, and residents are worried the brewery would only exacerbate the issue. Talking to the neighborhood, they don't see, and I don't either, how the city could justify giving the fielders the right to put this brewery in when they haven't addressed our issues out here, said Rodriguez. Then there is the matter of the local sewer system, which, according to City Secretary Jeffrey Calderon, has encountered infrastructure problems that the city is working to address. Petitioners against the brewery have expressed concern the system is not equipped to handle the brewery's wastewater. In an email provided by the fielders, Alpine City Utilities Director Keith Segar said Alpine's wastewater system was not capable of processing industrial wastewater like that of breweries, and when applying for their building permit, CISOs would have to provide mechanical drawings of their wastewater treatment system. According to Segar's email, the fielders said the only wastewater going into the city system will be from the restrooms and commercial kitchen. CISOs Brewery has plans to join other craft breweries in the nation in establishing their own wastewater treatment plant in order to reuse water used in beer production and mitigate impacts on the local sewer system. Tim Fielder, who will be the lead brewmaster for the facility, said the wastewater treatment facility will involve digging an 8 to 10 foot hole in the ground, which will hold a 500 gallon holding tank to catch wastewater. The water will then be treated in a 300 gallon treatment tank. He said the treated water will likely contain high concentrations of salts that will need to be removed before using the treated wastewater to irrigate their native gardens. He said digging the hole will likely be the most costly step in the process, and septic and water treatment supplies are easily available. To date, CISOs Brewery has made 2 presentations to City Council, and Lisa has met with many city council members regarding the project, as well as the mayor and other city officials, she said. Calderon said conversations between the city and the fielders have been procedural in nature and relate to permit, code, and zoning requirements. He said building plans must be submitted by the fielders before the city can comment further on the project. CISOs Brewery has recently received the public support of the Alpine Downtown Association, who said in a press release that they sympathize with citizens' concerns, but that it is important to welcome new businesses, and the fielders are working closely with the city. We believe the creation of this brewery could lead to significant economic growth in our Big Bend region, said ADA President Conley Rossor. The Big Bend Brewery was a great contributor to the community during its past existence.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, March 17th, 2022. City Cleanup Days, set for April 4th through the 14th, by Nathan Heuer. Fort Stockton residents will soon be able to get rid of unwanted bulky items and trash for free of charge via the annual spring cleanup in the city. The annual event will be held from April 4th through the 14th and feature pickup as well as an option for drop-off at the city's landfill for city residential customers paying for city sanitation services. Residents are encouraged to call a week prior for pickup by calling 432-336-8525 or 432-336-3092. Those wanting to dispose of their unwanted goods will be allowed up to 5 bulk items. Items should be separated and set out in the alley by their respective dumpsters on April 3rd. Accessible items include furniture, mattresses, large plastic toys, appliances, water heaters, scrap metal, yard waste, leaves, grass clippings, small clippings, brush, tree limbs less than 4 feet long and bundled with string or twine. If a resident wishes to dispose of their freezer, refrigerator, or air conditioner, Freon must be removed by a licensed technician with sticker attached. Items that are not allowed include construction debris, paint, hazardous materials. Residents may drop off acceptable items at the city's landfill by presenting a current city utility bill along with a valid ID such as a driver's license. CVB Board drops to 9 members, by Nathan Heuer. The Fort Stockton City Council unanimously approved a change to Convention and Visitors Bureau Board bylaws by March 14th at the group's regular meeting. The City Council approved the resignation CVB Board members of Jordan Gonzalez and Heather Noah at the meeting, and as a result, the board will now consist of 9 people instead of 11. The board was previously at 7 people in years past, but grew to 11 after the Fort Stockton Downtown Association officially dissolved last year. Gonzalez and Noah left the board due to obligations and conflicts with their schedules, according to City Manager Frank Rodriguez. What it was, those two members had conflict of schedules. It was hard for them to make the meetings at those times and those dates. They didn't want to do it, leave the board, but at the same time, they didn't want to hold anything up. It was hard to make a quorum. The quorum number for the group will move to 3 with the drop-in board members. The Street Maintenance Department for the City of Fort Stockton presented their street project plans for the coming summer at the City Council meeting on Monday. Interim Streets Supervisor Aaron Manzano presented a video slideshow that gave insight into the plans, and Public Works Director Luis Guerra aided by answering questions the council presented. I would like for the Public Works Director and the Interim Street Supervisor to receive the credit for putting this street plan together. These men worked hand in hand in coming up with the street to rehab. Our goal is to complete these streets, but a lot of it will depend on the weather. Manzano noted at the Monday's meeting that the street department is hoping to begin work by the end of April. Pecos County joins Area Sexual Assault Response Team, by Megan Waring. In response to new Texas law, Pecos County has formed an Adult Sexual Assault Response Team. Senate Bill 76 was passed during the 87th legislative session to require all counties across the state to form these teams. More than 14,000 cases of sexual assault in Texas were reported in 2019, according to the State Department of Public Safety. But more than often, the victim chooses to leave a case unreported. On March 14th, the Pecos County Commissioner's Court approved membership of the Big Bend Area Sexual Assault Response Team, along with representatives from the Pecos County Sheriff's Office and Fort Stockton Police Department. According to the law, the commissioner's court of each county shall establish a team that includes the following members: the chief administrator or the chief administrator's designee of a sexual assault program that provides services for the county, a prosecutor with county jurisdiction over cases involving sexual assault committed against adults, the chief or the chief's designee of the police department, the sheriff or the sheriff's designee, a sexual assault nurse examiner or a representative from the largest health care provider operating in the county, a behavioral health service provider operating in the county or representative from the county health department, other persons the presiding officer of the response team deems necessary. Two or more counties with a population of 250,000 residents or less may also partner to form a multi-county response team. The legislature says that certain people, elected officials or others, will be members of the team and they can refer or designate additional members. But the commissioner's court didn't estimate any additional people. We just authorized the sheriff to designate whoever he believes needs to be designated in addition to himself. Gonzalez's speech highlights Toastmasters meeting. Toastmaster, a nonprofit educational organization in Fort Stockton, hosted their regular meeting on February 25th. A delicious feast for lunch was provided by the organization's president, Karen Heffelfinger. Oscar Gonzalez, a seasoned Toastmasters member, was named the best speaker. He gave his best speech ever on a good name or a good example. It was a perfect speech, nearly bringing to tears to people's eyes. Thank you and congratulations, member Alicia Salinas said. Houston McKenzie, another seasoned member, took the Best Tabletop Speaker and Best Evaluator awards. Santa Acosta, McKenzie, and Gonzalez have been Toastmaster members for over 25 years. They are a prime example of the core values of Toastmasters. They lead with integrity, respect, service, and excellence. They, along with other dedicated members, have helped many people throughout the years gain communication, public speaking, and leadership skills that result in greater self-confidence and personal growth. Join the organization's supportive and positive learning environment on the second and fourth Fridays of each month at noon for 1 hour at the Fort Stockton Public Library. Lunch is provided. Contact Heffelfinger at 432-336-2541 for more information.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, March 10th. City issues Burke's Outlet sign permit, but store details remain vague. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Officials at Florida-based Burke's Outlet plan to open a store in Monahans, but details remain vague. After the company obtained a building permit from the city of Monahans to install a wall sign at 1203 South Stockton, the former Bell's location, the news reached out for comment. The permit, with an estimated value of $15,000, was issued by the city in February. Calls to the Director of Communications and Community Affairs for Bell's Incorporated, the parent company for Burke's Outlet, were not returned as of press time. Last December, local speculation from a Facebook post had many residents' hopes up about the potential of a new clothing and apparel store opening in town. At the time, Monahans Economic Development Director Ashley Adanto said, quote, "A site location for a Burke's Outlet was approved in October, but there is not a signed lease agreement for any location, including the old Bell store location next to Lowe's," end quote. Burke's Outlet is part of the Bell's family of stores and carries an array of clothes, shoes, and home goods, the store's website states. Council election canceled. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. With no challengers for the May 7th Monahan City Council election, members voted unanimously to cancel the election and declared those individuals as elected during Monday's regular meeting of the City Council. Incumbents District 1 Councilman Rudy Hernandez, District 4 Councilman Ishmael Ivy Valenzuela, and District 5 Councilman Richard Hawkins were all unopposed and are declared elected for another two-year term. Councilmen present for the meeting were Hernandez, Jeppy Wilson, Valenzuela, Calvin Carroll, and Hawkins. Mayor Adam Steen was also present. City Attorney Alan Nicholas was not present. In other business, a license and services agreement with Tyler Technologies was approved. Tyler Technologies will provide better hardware and software to enhance the efficiency of the Monahans Police Department to include citation management, computer-aided dispatch, real-time access to calls for service details and tolls to complete and submit reports, law enforcement records management to streamline the process of collecting, storing, and retrieving critical information, public safety analytics, and more are included in the package. Quote, the new agreement will replace the services that have been in place with Cologix with more features and will be less expensive, City Manager Rex Thee said. The agreement is for 5 years at a cost of $29,000 per year and will begin on October 2, 2022. The Council acknowledged the receipt of the Texas Gas Service Company annual reporting requirement per rate schedule pipeline integrity testing, or PIT, rider for the West Texas service area. The PIT rider permits Texas Gas to recover the cost of pipeline safety testing the company is required to perform by law. The PIT rate is an increase of about 3 cents per month for the average residential customer and about 17 cents for commercial customers. The Council approved accepting a reimbursement of $15,000 from the Friends of the Monahan Sandhills State Park Corporation. Quote, the corporation has not been active for several years and is now being dissolved. Since they received funds from the Hotel Motel Tax Fund, their bylaws stipulate that unused funds be returned to the city. No funds requests have been made since 2017, Thee said. A TIVA opioid settlement was acted on and approved by the council. The settlement is from a class action lawsuit by the state of Texas against TIVA in relation to the opioid. Monahan's will receive a settlement of $5,800 to be used for police training and drug enforcement and also prevents the city from any actions against TIVA. Accounts payable totaling $696,000 was approved. Departmental reports were also approved. Airport manager Brig Gregory reported $1,322 in FBO operations. Animal control officer Ben McAlvery reported 56 dogs and 8 cats were impounded, with 47 animals euthanized and 12 released. The building permits report from Joel Melendez reflected 8 residential and 9 commercial with a value of $321,000. Code compliance officer Richard Covington reported 3 violations for grass and weeds. 2 have been cleared. Junk vehicle violations were 24, with 20 cleared. The report of Monahan's Economic Development Corporation for February showed $95,000 in revenue and $19,000 in expenses for a net income of $76,000. The ending bank balance as of February 28th was $2,273,000. The minutes of the last MEDC meeting of January 24th was also included. The municipal court report showed 121 citations issued in February. Leading violations were truck route violations, 27, expired registration, 20, no driver's license, 11, speeding, 9, failed to maintain financial responsibility, 9, fines total $21,000. The fund balance report as of February 28th was $13.5 million. The council also approved tax roll adjustments. An expression of interest letter in support of the University of Texas Permian Basin to establish a Regional Security Operations Center, RSOC, was approved. If approved by the Comptroller of Texas, services could include real-time monitoring to detect network security events, alerts, and guidance for defeating threats, immediate response to counter security activity that exposes entities to risks, policy and planning to provide guidance on cybersecurity policies and cybersecurity educational awareness. Quote, this will benefit Monahans and area communities by providing low or no-cost cybersecurity, Thee said. In routine business, the council approved the minutes of the February 22nd meeting. The next council meeting will be held on March 22nd at 3 p.m. in the council chambers at City Hall, 112 West 2nd Street. Commissioners certify primary election. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Meeting in special session on Tuesday morning, the Ward County Commissioners certified the March 1st primary election results. The official election reconciliation results, as presented by County Clerk Denise Valles, reflected a total of 1,874 Republican ballots and 142 Democratic ballots. For the Republican primary, 1,034 votes were cast in early voting, 786 on Election Day, and 54 mail ballots. The Democratic primary vote count was 58 early votes, 60 Election Day, and 24 mail ballots. Voter turnout was 29.4% of the 6,856 registered voters within the county, a total of 2,016 voters cast ballots, 29.4%. Commissioners present for the short meeting were Tino Sanchez, Larry Hanna, Dexter Nichols, and Eddie Gnomes. County Judge Greg Holly was also present. Rodriguez Garcia advanced to state meet. Lady Lobos, 7th overall at regional meet. 23 Lady Lobos were in the field for Saturday's Region 1 Division 2 powerlifting meet held at the Ward County Event Center. Two Lady Lobos emerged from the field with top performances in Class 4A Division 2 in their respective weight classes to punch their tickets to the Texas High School Women's Powerlifting State Meet in Corpus Christi, held March 17th through 19th. Yareli Rodriguez took the top spot for Class 4A Division 2 competitors in the 114-pound weight class by squatting 245 pounds, bench pressing 120 pounds, and deadlifting 255 pounds for a total weight of 620 pounds. Renata Garcia earned a berth at the state meet with a top performance for Class 4A Division II schools in the 132-pound weight class. Garcia ended with a 275-pound squat, a 130-pound bench press, and a 290-pound deadlift to finish with a total weight of 695 pounds. This year was the first year where girls' regionals have utilized the Class 4A football divisional breakdown to have the top two performers from Division I and Division II schools advancing to the state meet. With 16 high schools represented in the field, the Lady Lobos finished in 7th place overall, earning 9 points. Perennial powerlifting powerhouse Perryton won the team title with 67 points. Pecos was 2nd overall with 24 points. Fort Stockton was 3rd. Head coach Fred Howard said, quote, "All the Lady Lobos just brought their A game and competed extremely well. We had personal bests all the way across the board. The kids had to fight and they were up for the challenge," end quote. It was the second day of Monahans hosting Region 1 powerlifting action, as they also hosted the 6A and 5A schools on Friday. Quote, "Special thanks to Coach Jacob Brink and Coach Scott Tannenberger for being Johnny on the spot when I had to deal with stuff as a director, and then, of course, all the volunteers and the companies who donated money for all the meals and things. It was just a great community effort," Howard added. The boys' regional meet was held March 8th. Meet coverage can be found in the next issue of the Monahans News.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.